I love listening to podcasts, but did you know you can read this one too? Signed copies of The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God book are available at my website, justinbriley.com. Professor John Lennox says, this is a first-rate book. Get it, read it, and give it to others. And who am I to argue with Professor Lennox? Or if you appreciate this podcast and would like the book, why not become a gold supporter via Patreon or US tax deductible giving? And as well as getting early access to new episodes, I'll send you signed copies of both my books. For the book and to support, go to justinbriley.com or click the links with today's show.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Who was Jesus? Is he a historical character? Who wrote the Gospels? Why are they written in Greek? Why did they have a pro-Roman perspective? Why was the religion headquartered in Rome? Those were the mysteries that I saw about the Gospels.
The origin of the Christian religion has been a subject steeped in mystery for nearly 2,000 years.
This is the dramatic promo for a book titled Caesar's Messiah by one Joseph Atwill, with his daring new thesis on whether Jesus really existed.
Joseph Atwill is one of a number of scholars today from all around the world who are questioning the historic facts behind these ancient mysteries. When examining the actual history of this era, many of the answers provided by the church and Christian scholars do not hold up to rigorous scrutiny.
This is really important for our culture, to understand where Christianity came from.
Despite the breathless intrigue of the advert, Atwill's book would probably have made little impact, even when he put on a press conference in London in 2013, were it not for the influence of none other than Richard Dawkins, who tweeted out the claims of its PR campaign to his thousands of followers, including the book's thesis that everything we thought we knew about Jesus and the rise of Christianity is a gigantic hoax perpetrated by the Roman aristocracy. The only problem with all this was that Atwill had neither scholarly credentials, he's a retired computer programmer, nor a jot of support from any academic in historical studies. It turned out that the author's theory was regarded as way out, even within the Jesus mythicist movement, a group considered to be left field to begin with. Atwill was the fringe of the fringe. The only difference was that he had the money to publish a book, employ a publicity agency, rent a hall in central London, and get the endorsement of a well-known atheist professor of zoology. In fact, this was not the first time Dawkins himself had promoted the idea that Jesus perhaps never existed.
In your book, The God Delusion, you say that it's under scholarly dispute among historians that Jesus actually existed.
This is Oxford professor John Lennox in a public discussion with Dawkins, challenging him on his historical claims.
Now, I checked with the ancient historians. That is not so. And it disturbed me. History is not natural science. But what I don't understand is this, why you would write something like that.
I don't think it's a very important question whether Jesus existed. There are some historians, most historians think he did. Some
they certainly do. I couldn't find an ancient historian that didn't.
Well, there are one or two, but I don't really care, actually, because precisely because it's petty.
Petty or not, Dawkins' willingness to promote far-fetched conspiracy theories about Jesus over the vast weight of credible academic scholarship was a feature of New Atheism in its heyday. Take, for instance, this toe-curling exchange between New Testament scholar Bart Ehrman and Reginald Finlay, host of the Infidel Guy show, a popular podcast among skeptics at the time. Finlay had apparently expected Ehrman, a non-Christian and a well-known critic of the historicity of aspects of the Bible, to be as skeptical of Jesus's existence as he and his audience were. But that's not quite how things went.
What is the evidence? Because even that we cannot know for sure. But I guess you would say we can look at the earliest manuscripts that date to what, around when he should have existed or something, or what? What do we have? Because we don't have anything that exists right until after he died, allegedly, right?
About him, you mean?
Right, about Jesus.
Well, that's true of everyone.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, not really. Aren't there some? I thought there were some. Well, I guess so. But I thought that there are some contemporary that there are some writers who'd write about people as they existed, like with Julius Caesar, weren't
right,
there?
But Julie, we don't have. I mean, we don't have anybody from that time talking to us now. All we have are ancient records.
Right, but again,
and all we have for Jesus are ancient records.
But we don't have any ancient records of anyone who wrote about Jesus while he was alive, do we?
No, absolutely not.
And
we don't
have. That's the difference.
Just as we don't have for billions of people who lived in the past that we're pretty sure existed. I mean, we have more evidence for Jesus than we have for almost anybody from his time period. So, I mean, you know, I'm not saying this as a believer. I'm not a believer. But as a historian, I'm just saying that you can't just kind of dismiss it and say, well, you know, we don't know. I mean, you have to look at the evidence. So there is hard evidence, I think.
Okay.
Ehrman went on to offer various evidences for Jesus' existence, including Paul's writings to Jesus' followers and his mention of Jesus' brother, James.
Because everybody that he's writing to knows who he's talking about, so he just makes the off-the-cuff comment. That's very important information.
Mm-hmm. And that is if he wrote them.
Now, why would he make an off-the-cuff comment about the 12 disciples? So the whole point is that you've got a disinterested comment from somebody who actually knew these people.
If he even wrote that, though, correct? Because isn't there some...
No, there's no doubt about Paul writing Galatians.
Aren't there some theories that suggest that maybe Paul himself had scribe that wrote for him?
Every person who wrote epistles in the ancient world dictated them to scribes.
Right, so how do we know then that...
Well, how do you know Cicero wrote his letters?
I don't. I'm not a historian, so I don't know much about
right.
Cicero, but...
No, I am a historian, I'm telling you.
Rather like Dawkins, Finlay seemed to be determined, against all the evidence, to reach a negative conclusion about Jesus' existence. A reminder that even those who claim to be ruled by reason can still be influenced more by their feelings than pure facts. But as the trenchant anti-theism of New Atheism has fallen away in recent years, a more measured approach to the historical case for Jesus and the Bible is coming to the fore again. Already in this series, we've heard about the way public thinkers such as Jordan Peterson, Tom Holland, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and others have turned against the new atheism and are reminding their secular peers of how important the Bible is to the West and the way its central character, Jesus, has shaped our moral instincts and can still be a source of great psychological and philosophical wisdom. But I want to push them a step further. I think there's enough evidence in the Bible to persuade intelligent, modern, skeptical, 21st century people that Jesus is more than just really great mythology.
I mean, I'm a historian of Christianity, not of the first century period, but I'm a historian of Christianity. And I think I had somehow just absorbed from the ether sort of mid-20th century Jesus seminar, sort of New Testament criticism view that, well, it's sort of all...
It's all a bit fuzzy.
Fuzzy. It's kind of like a game of telephone. Who knows what happened? You know, there's this, like, core Jesus we can't access, and then the accretions of all the supernatural stuff. But I'd never really done my homework.
Towards the end of today's show, exploring the real history of the evidence for Jesus and the Bible, we'll meet Molly Worthen with her own story of a surprising rebirth of belief in God.
It turns out that there is a lot more quite interesting, provocative, and compelling historical evidence around, you know, that set of events than I had realized.
I'm Justin Brierley, and throughout my working life, I've been hosting conversations on faith between atheists, agnostics, and believers. In this documentary series, I'm telling the story of why new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. I'm speaking to those inside and outside the atheist movement and the many new thinkers beginning a new conversation on the value of faith. Along the way, we're meeting some of those who have found themselves surprised by God as they've made the journey from atheism to Christianity. Welcome to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Episode 15, More Than Mythology. Just before we jump into the rest of today's show, one of the voices you'll hear on this podcast is friend of the show Glenn Scrivener, a brilliant Christian communicator. Glenn has recently put together an online course called 321. It's an introduction to Christianity that's imaginative, stimulating, and assumes no prior knowledge. If you've been thinking about exploring faith for yourself, or if you want something to share with your friends, 321 is just the thing. Glenn presents 8 video-led sessions which are beautifully shot and animated. I found it a really engaging and practical way of connecting the big ideas in this podcast to our everyday life. I'm already thinking of people I can share it with. See for yourself at 321course.com/JB. It's completely free. Just start a free account with your email and a password and you're in. There's no spam, no hidden costs. Go to 321course.com/JB and discover life according to Jesus.
It starts with a gruesome murder in the most famous museum in the world. From there, an epic tale unfolds. Secret societies are exposed, religion is rewritten, and our very notion of Jesus is questioned. It's an historical whodunit that's captivated the world and caused much debate over just what is fact and what is fiction.
I began as a skeptic. As I started researching Da Vinci Code, I really thought I would disprove a lot of this theory about Mary Magdalene and Holy Blood and all of that. I became a believer.
That was the opening of a 60 Minutes Australia documentary from 2005, tracing the blockbuster success of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, a novel which sold over 22 million copies by mixing historical facts with fiction, arguably birthing the genre of faction, and leaving many readers convinced of its claims about Jesus.
When the Da Vinci Code came out, I had no idea it was going to be so controversial.
This is Dan Brown appearing at the time on the BBC's Hard Talk show.
For those who haven't read it, and there aren't many in the world, but let's just remind them, you know, you posited, it was an extremely complex story, but at the heart of it was the notion that there was and is a conspiracy at the heart of Christianity to hide the true story of Jesus Christ.
That he was a mortal prophet, not literally the Son of God. A hypothetical.
And you tell me that you didn't realize it was going to be controversial.
Because it's a thriller. And my feeling is like, if your faith is shaken to the core by a thriller, I think you need to look at your faith. And what happened with the book? The reason it was so controversial, I guess, is the only word, is that for a lot of people, the story I told in that novel made more rational sense than the story they heard in Sunday school. And certainly for me, the story I told in the Da Vinci Code makes more logical sense to me than the story I learned in Sunday school. And that's what was so dangerous. If the book had sold 10 copies, nobody would have worried about it.
Well, that's true. And far from selling 10, it sold hundreds of millions in the end and has been translated all around the world. But one of the problems that those defending the Christian story had with the book was that they felt you melded fact and fiction in a way that was completely unreasonable and led many readers to be deeply confused about where the lines between fact and fiction really were.
That's precisely what I do.
Whatever you think of Dan Brown's famous book, it was a good example of the way modern culture tends towards conspiracy theories, something that's only accelerated in the era of social media. We all love a conspiracy theory, don't we? Especially when it comes to Jesus. In fact, a 2016 survey reported that 22% of people in the UK think Jesus was a mythical figure, while 17% are unsure whether he was real or not. If accurate, this means that nearly 40% of people doubt the existence of Jesus, a staggering indication of how pervasive such scepticism has become. Atheist blogs, websites, and conferences were the main engine for the rise of the so-called Jesus mythicist movement. Despite the fact that no widely respected historian holds to the mythicist position, if you type "Did Jesus exist?" into a search engine, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the issue is a seriously contested one. Skeptical websites and articles abound, the vast majority of which are run by atheists. Historian Tim O'Neill is a non-believer who's had many run-ins with the mythicist community himself through his own website and popular blog, History for Atheists. Speaking here on the Reason to Doubt podcast, he explained how he's seen the movement grow since first encountering it in the 1980s.
Back then it wasn't a prominent thing at all. It was largely considered to be something that people had looked at back in the early 20th century. But more recently it has popped up, particularly online, and is accepted by a quite a large proportion of it. It's almost see an online survey about this topic. I see a good sort of 20 or 30% of atheists give it credence, and that is directly out of proportion to the number of actual scholars who give it credence. Now, I'm not making an argument from authority. I'm not saying we should accept that Jesus probably did exist because scholars do. But when you've got a very large number of scholars from all kinds of backgrounds, not just Christian, you know, also Jewish and atheistic scholars who do accept it, then you probably should wonder, well, why do they not find Jesus' mythicism convincing, whereas people like David Fitzgerald, your previous guest, clearly do.
I was going to say, one thing that I find fascinating too is I sort of lump atheist and skeptic into the same group in my mind, but I know that's not true. And I sort of just cringe whenever I hear atheists making some of these unfounded claims or you know, spouting off some of this. It's almost like conspiracy stuff on the internet when it comes to mythicism. So I don't know if you have any similar experiences with that.
What I certainly have found is that some of the people who find mythicism convincing are quite zealous about it. They have this almost evangelical zeal, and I suspect that has got something to do with the fact that many of them come from a fundamentalist Christian background, and they seem to have, you know, this is not the case in all cases at all, but in many cases they seem to have kind of replaced one type of zealous belief with another, because they get very angry with me, and you know, I've had people they send me hate mail, and I've had people abuse me and stuff, which is all very weird.
Agnostic Bible scholar Bart Ehrman, whose toe-curling interview we heard earlier, rose to prominence in skeptical circles for books such as Misquoting Jesus, casting doubt on the reliability of the transmission of the New Testament documents. But after meeting Jesus mythicists time and time again among the new atheists who liked his work, he published a book that didn't go down so well with many of them. Did Jesus Exist? The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth was a book that directly took aim at mythicists. In this interview for the Holy Kool-Aid podcast, he explains why, ironically, the arguments of these modern enemies of Christianity are undermined by the ancient enemies of Christianity when it comes to the mythicist movement.
Not just the friends of Jesus, the enemies of Jesus. Nobody denied he existed. Everybody knew he existed. The question is he actually God or not? Is he the Son of God or not? It wasn't a question whether there was a man Jesus. Everybody knew there was a man Jesus. That's why it's this modern invention. I mean, it came about during the Enlightenment in the 18th century by people who hated Christianity and wanted to show the whole thing's based on a myth. They had an agenda. And it wasn't history. It was just, you know, you just want to show these people are idiots because they worship a myth and they think he's a history. It's like, but you're just making stuff up here. Historians shouldn't do that. Yeah. So no, I mean, you just think of all the enemies of Christianity in antiquity. Pliny hated Christianity. Tacitus hated Christianity. Lucian Samosata hated Christianity. Celsus hated Christianity. I mean, you just go through the whole list. You have these big books written about Jesus by enemies of Jesus. Celsus, oh my God, we wish we had that book still. We have it only in quotations by the church father Origen. He's this guy, Celsus, who's this pagan intellectual who writes an attack on Christianity and goes after Jesus ruthlessly. But it's never that he didn't exist. It's that he didn't really do his miracles, or that, in fact, he was just this lower class peasant. He was crucified. Nobody should believe him. I mean, he makes fun of Jesus, but none of the enemies of Jesus make claims, oh yeah, actually he never existed. It's a modern invention.
I sat down with Australian New Testament scholar John Dixon, host of the Undeceptions podcast, to find out why he thinks the mythicist view has been so pervasive.
Yet we live in a culture which is highly skeptical. Very often you don't have to search far to find quote-unquote Jesus mythicism, the idea even that Jesus never existed. Why do you think that's so common in our culture today?
I think there's a general cynicism and skepticism directed toward religion, and it's manifested itself in a kind of absolute denial of Jesus' historicity. So it seems to me no accident that that mythicism has come to the fore in precisely the time, you know, the new atheism, so-called, rose to prominence. And it was, you know, someone like Dawkins said things like, Jesus said, or whoever wrote his script, if he didn't live. He also said, a reasonable historical case can be made that Jesus never lived at all. Not that he's claiming that Jesus never lived, but a reasonable historical case. And so people sort of felt buoyed by that. Michel Onfray from France, you know, swashbuckling French atheism, said the whole thing is fabrications. And so I just think the recent denial of Jesus' very existence has come out of that same mood. But it hasn't really moved the dial in history circles. I mean, the latest edition of the Oxford Classical Dictionary still has an entry on Jesus that doesn't even countenance the possibility that he didn't live. It's not like, you know, if you go to Apollonius of Tyana, the Oxford Classical Dictionary raises a big question mark over everything, you know. But with Jesus, absolutely he lived. There can't be any doubt in ancient history circles. I also find that theologians can be way more skeptical about the New Testament than my classical historian colleagues. Classical scholars, they're just so used to dealing with texts as your doorway to the past, always reading them critically, but knowing that people tend not to just make things up whole cloth. They might have skewed information, so you've always got to ask, was the author in a position to know the information they report? Humans do tend to exaggerate. They have bias. But so long as you're holding all of that in mind and asking the right questions of the text is a really good way of understanding the past. So that's how classicists operate. Whereas I think sort of more philosophically, theologically driven people have a skepticism. I remember one of my colleagues in ancient history at Macquarie University said to me, theologians are so skeptical about their New Testament material. We'd kill for the kind of materials you have. And what she was meaning was the New Testament texts are very early as far as texts go. I mean, just compare Tacitus, our best source for Tiberius, the emperor I mentioned. Tacitus is writing, 80 years after Tiberius is dead. But Tacitus is still our very best source for Tiberius. Well, the New Testament is all written long before Tacitus. Our latest text, probably John's Gospel, although I have quibbles about that, I'm not sure anymore. I think maybe John is a bit earlier. But anyway, let's just go with what is the mainstream. John's written in the 90s. That's still only 60 years. And Paul's writing about the year 50. So that's 20 years after Jesus. That's about as good as it gets. And so as a piece of ancient history, we can say pretty confidently that the broad narrative of Jesus' life is a piece of ancient history.
I've sometimes given similar examples of the archaeology and other aspects of the tradition in which this was handed down as being good historical evidence that the authors knew what they were talking about, and that historically this fits. Something sometimes people come back with is, yes, but Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set Sherlock Holmes in a historical London. Couldn't it have been the same for the gospel writers? And especially they'll point out the fact that there are miracles recorded, not least the resurrection of Jesus himself. And that alone for them discounts this as being able to be taken seriously. So what do you do about the fact that these seem to have a historical pedigree, but have what for many people will be this aspect of them that just discounts them as being historically credible?
We know what a first century or an ancient novel looked like. There is such a thing. Calero is a great example. And the Gospels look nothing like it. So in terms of genre studies, no one thinks the Gospels are fiction in that sense. They look more like ancient biographies. And biographies generally were of real people. So I don't think that really works. The other thing is the multiple lines of evidence. So it isn't just that we have one novel of Sherlock Holmes, it's that we have multiple different people talking in broad terms about the same figure. So Paul's letters are a separate tradition from the Gospel of Mark, are a separate tradition from the shared source of Matthew and Luke that scholars call Q, are a separate tradition from the Epistle of James. None of these texts have been copied from one another, and they all are basically reporting the same thing as events in time and space. On those grounds alone, it's impossible to think of this as a shared piece of fiction or as a novel. And of course, there are non-Christian references, passing references, not of great value, but nonetheless real references. Two in Josephus and one in Tacitus, one in Pliny, that just overall, when you just look at the multiple lines of evidence, leave the impression this was a real story.
While public and online perception has been swinging towards the idea that Jesus was a legendary or mythical figure, the reality is that in recent years, the academic consensus has been swinging in the opposite direction. In the late 19th and early 20th century, the so-called form or higher criticism view, which saw the Gospels as largely an accretion of mythology and theology, meant a sceptical view of what we know of Jesus' life came to dominate. But there's been a surprising rebirth of belief in the reliability of the Gospels in recent years. In this interview with John Anderson, Christian thinker William Lane Craig explains what has changed.
Well, here again, John, interestingly enough, a similar revolution to the one I described in philosophy and in physics has taken place in New Testament studies. The skepticism of the 19th century and early 20th century about the reliability of the Gospels was rooted in the fact that scholars interpreted them against the backdrop of pagan mythology. And so they thought of these narratives as overlain with layers of myth and legend. But what has happened in the second half of the 20th century and now on into the 21st is what has been aptly called the Jewish reclamation of Jesus. Scholars have come to appreciate that Greco-pagan mythology is just the wrong interpretive background for Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus was a Jew, and all the disciples were Jew. And the proper interpretive context for understanding Jesus of Nazareth is first century Palestinian Judaism. And when the Gospels are read against that backdrop, they emerge as very credible sources for the life and teachings of this man. I think it would be no exaggeration to speak of a reversal of scholarship with respect to the credibility of the Gospels. Back in the 1940s, Rudolf Bultmann, a prominent New Testament critic, said that the historical information about Jesus of Nazareth could probably be written entirely on a 4x6 index card. Today, however, the Gospels are widely regarded as belonging to the genre of ancient biography, and as such, are very credible sources for the life of Jesus of Nazareth. We have four biographies of Jesus, which is almost unprecedented for major figures of the ancient world. And so there has been quite a reversal of scholarship with respect to the historical Jesus and the credibility of the sources for him.
One of the key contemporary New Testament scholars rediscovering the uniquely Jewish world of Jesus and his contemporaries is Professor N.T. Wright, author of many academic and popular level books on early Christianity. Wright is someone I've had the privilege of engaging in conversations many times over the years, but the first time I ever recorded an interview with him for Premier Unbelievable happened to be shortly after Joseph Atwill's book, Denying the Existence of Jesus as a Roman Political Conspiracy, had been making waves. And I still remember Wright's response.
The crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth is one of the best attested facts in ancient history. And I speak as an ancient historian. There are certain other things like the murder of Julius Caesar, the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, all sorts of other things which actually we know pretty certainly and which no ancient historian denies. I gather there is yet another book just come out, I can't even remember the author's name, saying that Jesus never existed, saying that this was all invented 70 years later by the Romans in order to keep people quiet. This is complete nonsense, and no serious ancient historian would take it seriously for a minute. If we take Jesus out of the world of first century Palestinian Judaism and say maybe such a figure never existed, there are 1,000 other things that we just simply can't explain. We have all sorts of evidence which points back to the certainty of there being this figure, and particularly the certainty of his crucifixion. The crucifixion itself is one of the best bits of evidence, because in the ancient world, the word cross or crucifixion was almost like a swear word. You wouldn't want to say it in polite company or in front of your grandmother, because it was so horrible and barbaric and disgusting, and bodies hanging on crosses being eaten by rats and vermin and birds and so on. You just shudder and look away. And yet the Christians made the cross the symbol from the very beginning of their movement, because for them it was the sign of the love of God. Without something like the actual death of Jesus, that cultural shift is impossible to explain.
More recently, I was able to sit down with N.T. Wright, or Tom as he's more informally known, to ask about how he has seen his field of scholarship change over the years. Biblical scholarship itself, it also feels like there's been a journey of sorts over the last century or so, because in a way, what dominated the academy was that sort of form criticism of the sort of the German scholars and so on, who were essentially saying, well, we can't really know anything about the history of this and the historicity and so on. I mean, could you just give us a sort of overview of the way in which that really has changed in the past 100, 150 years?
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Huge, huge questions and story. And I love going into all that. And anyone who hasn't read my book, History and Eschatology, there is a lot about exactly these questions in those early chapters, particularly. Basically, a lot of New Testament scholarship in the 19th and 20th century has been dominated by people in the German Lutheran tradition. Now, the German Lutheran tradition has great strengths, but attention to history, ironically, has not been one of them, because they have called themselves historical, critical, or whatever. But actually, what they've done is they've used just enough historical skepticism from Hume and Gibbon and the 18th century, etc., to weaken one's grip grip on the happenedness of the history, especially of Jesus, in order to say, but actually the events aren't the important thing. What matters is the challenge to believe, or the challenge to convert, or the challenge to decide for God in the present moment. And so don't worry about what actually happened. Listen for this challenge coming to you today. And that was associated particularly with the great German scholar Rudolf Bultmann. But that's philosophically what is known as idealism, that is, getting away from the historical reality as the basic thing and saying what matters is the ideas and the belief and so on, which then they were able to say, well, there you are, that's justification by faith. You don't need history, you just have to believe. And that's a travesty of what justification by faith really was. What has changed particularly in the last two generations has been the rediscovery of the Jewish world of the New Testament. And this is partly many scholars seeing the awful tragedy of the Holocaust in the 1930s and 40s and have realized that that grew out of a Christianity, so-called, which was actually holding off from Judaism and saying that the Jewish world was a bad world and was against the gospel and that we had to break away from the Jewish vision.
I mean, in a way, that sort of way of thinking about the Gospels and Jesus sort of is still, you know, quite present in many forums. You know, the Jesus seminar, I suppose, not that long ago, was still sort of saying, well, look, we don't really know, you know, what Jesus really said and so on. I mean, what difference does it make, and what's happened in your view that means we can actually latch onto the historical Jesus, and why does that matter for the way we then understand our faith?
Many people who talk about this stuff really don't understand how ancient history works. Of course, for much of ancient history, ancient Greece and ancient Rome, we are reduced to having one or at most two sources for what's going on. You know, ancient Greece, we've got Herodotus and Thucydides, and we've got the plays and the philosophers, etc. But there are whole decades in Athens or Sparta where we know next to nothing. For the Roman history of the period we're talking about, okay, you've got the letters and speeches of Cicero, you've got the writings of Julius Caesar, this is a couple of generations before Jesus and Paul, but then for the early imperial period, you've got Tacitus, Suetonius, Valerius Paterculus, Dio Cassius a bit later, but the historian is constantly trying to put these all together and saying, what makes sense within that world? The better we know it, does this account make sense? And even if it's only in one source, if it makes sense and makes itself at home within that world, then many historians, not because they're credulous or silly, but just because that's how history works, they say, well, we can make sense of this. We can see how it fits. And so as I read Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, and as I put them into the world which we know from Josephus and the scrolls, etc., as well as the Greco-Roman world of the period, again and again I come back, as I've done in my work over my lifetime, and say, look, here's a way in which it may well make sense. Now, it doesn't mean that all my interpretations of every saying ascribed to Jesus are correct and accurate. Of course, that'd be highly unlikely. But I will argue till the cows come home that those make sense in a way which the reductionism of the earlier days really, really doesn't. The problem was that the reductionism of the very devout Lutherans, like people like Rudolf Bultmann, was a way of saying, don't bother about what actually happened, bother about what God is saying to you today. Now, that's at one level, for a preacher, that's not a bad thing to say. But then if it gets into the hands of people who want to say, oh, well, maybe the Gospels were just made up later on, so maybe we don't have to take Jesus' challenge to us very seriously, or people who say, oh, well, they all seem to have thought the world was going to end any minute, and we now know they were wrong, so they were probably wrong about a lot of other things as well. And that has sapped the vitals of Western Christianity, of people who said, oh, well, Paul was wrong about the Second Coming, so obviously he's wrong about ethics, and he's probably wrong about the role of women or whatever. And that has just given free license to people to play fast and loose in a way which genuine history, which is what I and many others, is not just me, for goodness sake, what many of us have been trying to do for years, would not support that kind of approach. But I'm summarizing summarizing very big and complex issues, but it's a way of saying, yes, there are still problems. I had an email from somebody yesterday who'd just been reading Bart Ehrman, and oh dear, how can I still believe? And just sent him a little message saying one or two things. So obviously, people need to be reassured, but not to say stop thinking, but go on thinking, but think more deeply about what history is and what the history of the first century really is.
Before we jump back into today's show, a shout out to Figaro in Canada, who left a review saying, "This is, quite simply, the most interesting and well-produced podcast I've ever listened to. Outstanding." Leaving a rating and a review of the show helps others to discover it, but if you can become a monthly supporter of the podcast, it makes a huge difference. Silver level supporters get early access to new episodes and bonus content, such as the video of our recent conversation event with Tom Holland. Gold supporters also get signed copies of both my books and an opportunity for a monthly catch-up with me on Zoom. If you love the show, why not support it today at justinbriley.com or just follow the links with today's show notes.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Well, a sewage worker gets sent out to fix a broken line, but he ends up unearthing something with spiritual and historical significance. In the process of digging up that line, he hits something besides a pipe. It turns out he stumbled upon an ancient pool under the streets of East Jerusalem. Archaeologists believe it's the pool of Siloam, where, according to the Gospel of John, Jesus healed a blind man.
This is CNN reporting on an exciting discovery in Jerusalem in 2004.
No one was more excited than archaeologist Eli Shukran, who was there when the steps to the ancient pool were actually unearthed. He joins me now live from Jerusalem. Eli, tell me what it felt like and what was going through your mind when you saw the steps.
It was exciting. You know, 2,000 years, no one knows exactly where is the pool. And now you touch, you found it, you touch the stone, you touch the pottery, you touch the coin, and it gives you a great feel.
Prior to 2004, skeptics assumed the Pool of Siloam probably didn't exist. However, after construction work revealed the grand pool and archaeologists discovered coins in the plaster of the pool dating to the years before and after Jesus, it made exact sense of the story of Jesus healing the blind man in chapter 9 of John's Gospel. And the Pool of Siloam isn't the only location associated with Jesus' healing ministry that has been unearthed. In the 1880s, a pool was discovered, which further work in the 1960s confirmed was the Pool of Bethesda, also mentioned in John's Gospel. This is archaeologist Titus Kennedy speaking on the Think Biblically podcast about its five porticos, or stoas, mentioned by John.
He talks about these five stoas, and that stumped a lot of scholars in terms of what was the shape of this pool. Like, why is it described with five stoas? Is it five-sided? But when this area was excavated, they found that the fifth stoa ran through the middle, essentially dividing the pool into upper and lower sections. And so John was describing it very accurately. He just didn't go in and give us a shape, but he did tell us how many different stoas were there. So, you know, that was a real location, and people had the memory preserved, so to speak. They knew that some miraculous healing had happened there. And when Hadrian came in the second century, Emperor Hadrian, and he tried to essentially erase the historical memory of Christianity, or he tried to syncretize it with Roman deities, he had a temple to Asclepius built over the Pool of Bethesda, and that's the Greek and Roman god of healing. And so he wanted people to associate the healing miracle with the work of Asclepius, not with Jesus. And I would say that's something that at least tells us the story was swirling around and people knew about the story of Jesus healing this man at Bethesda.
That excitement that archaeologists like Eli Shukron and Titus Kennedy experience in being able to touch and see the places where Jesus walked and talked has been repeated in locations across Israel in an increasing number of finds that corroborate the New Testament accounts. These include recently excavated houses, settlements, and synagogues that have overturned previous skepticism about the cultural and religious significance of the towns where Jesus carried out his ministry, such as Nazareth and Capernaum. The remains of crucifixion victims also confirm the nature of Jesus' execution as related in the Gospels. Archaeology, however, is only one of several exciting areas where new discoveries and research are shedding fresh light on the historicity of the New Testament. So let's start with the actual written record that tell us about the life of Jesus and the people, places, and activities he engaged in. The four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each giving its own biographical account of the life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Can we trust them? Well, in this area, scholarship has had an embarrassment of riches for some time. It's well known that there are a number of extra-biblical sources that reference Jesus and the early Christian movement, written by ancient historians like Josephus, Tacitus, and Pliny the Younger. But our main sources of information about Jesus are, of course, the four Gospels themselves, and those documents are among the most reliable we have from that era. A rule of thumb when gauging historical authenticity is that the closer to the events the original texts were written down, the more reason we have to believe they're reliable. In addition, the earlier the extant copies of those texts are, and the more copies we have of them, the greater the likelihood we can reconstruct an accurate version of those first accounts. Naturally, most texts from the ancient world written on papyrus have crumbled to dust over the millennia, yet early fragments of documents still turn up even today. So how do the New Testament documents compare in these terms to other ancient documents? Well, as John Dixon mentioned earlier, it turns out extremely well. In fact, the New Testament outclasses most other ancient records of historical figures and events by a country mile. When looking at other key historical figures of the ancient world, there are typically only a handful of existing documents that detail their lives. In addition, those accounts were usually written down many years or even centuries following the events. In contrast, the four Gospel accounts are estimated to have been written within 30 to 60 years of Jesus' life, and many of the letters of the Apostle Paul that witnessed to the same events were written even sooner. Moreover, there are thousands of surviving manuscripts, many of which date to within a century or so of the events. Compare this to most other accounts from ancient history where our surviving documents have gaps of hundreds, if not thousands of years from the originals. But having lots of copies means having lots of differences between them as transcription errors and additions creep in over time. Wouldn't that mean that these documents have been irreparably metastasized and mythologized over the course of time and transmission? In fact, the opposite is true. As Amy Orr Ewing, author of Why Trust the Bible, explains in this lecture for the C.S. Lewis Institute.
So these manuscripts are good evidence for us that what was written originally is what we're reading today in translation in English. And that's there's a process called textual criticism, but a rigorous process of looking at and examining these documents that enable us to reconstruct or to construct what the original New Testament said. And we can have faith and trust in that process because we can scrutinize it and look at it. And where variations do exist, they're not hidden. We can compare that with other worldviews, which I won't go into, where variants exist, they're suppressed, hidden, burned, not spoken of. In the New Testament, where it's necessary, where there are perhaps one word that's different in one manuscript or in another, it's referred to in the margin of the translation of your Bible. Your eye is drawn to it. Why? Because there's no conspiracy about this. This is an extraordinary, trustworthy document.
As Amy Orr Ewing says, through the science of textual criticism and the advent of digital technology, scholars have increasingly been able to cross-examine a wide range of biblical texts and reconstruct what the original document said with extraordinary accuracy. But it's not just the historical pedigree of the manuscript evidence that denotes the reliability of these stories. It's the fact that modern scholars are increasingly uncovering a range of reasons to trust that they're reporting eyewitness testimony rather than second or third-hand information. Lydia McGrew is a Christian thinker who's recently authored Testimonies to the Truth: Why You Can Trust the Gospels. Her research shows that the details of the four Gospels also confirm their accuracy and reliability in terms of their knowledge of historical events and characters, along with local customs and culture, things that you had to be a local to know, including the geography of the area.
Well, locations can be really difficult to get right, especially when they're somewhat obscure. So what I'm including here are what are known as external confirmations, having anything to do with geography, the shape of the land, whether you go uphill or downhill, but also rulers and what locations they ruled, sometimes some rather obscure rulers and locations that we find confirmed. And these are much harder to get right than you might think, because it's not like there was some sort of atlas or Google or even a set of Britannica encyclopedias that you could go and say, hey, you know, I want to make up a story and I want to set it in Syria, and I want to find out who are the rulers of these places in Syria. Okay, I got that. I'll put that in my story. There was no good way to do that at all. And yet the authors get these types of things related to rulership and place names and geography right again and again.
So give us perhaps one specific example where it would have been very difficult to have got this right if you weren't from that time and place and recording events that you were directly connected with at some level.
If you look at Luke chapter 3 and just the very first couple of verses there, he's trying to tell you when John the Baptist first started his ministry. And he has a whole bunch of names of rulers who were at that time. You know, he wants to really nail that down. So it's like in the year of this, and then he says the word of the Lord came to John in the wilderness, right? So that's what he's trying to nail down. So just one example there, he mentions someone named Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene. And in Josephus, we find mention of a Lysanias who ruled in that location, but it can't be the one that Luke is talking about, because it was in the time of Antony and Cleopatra, which was, you know, prior to the birth even of Jesus, right? So naturally enough, skeptics believed that this was a mistake on Luke's part. But around 1912, an inscription was discovered in Abila, which is in Syria, and it was by a freedman, someone who used to be a slave, who dedicated a street. And he said that he was a freedman of Lysanias. And there it is. It's right there. And there was something in the inscription, he mentioned the Augusti, which dates it to the time that Luke is talking about. So it looks like there actually was a second Lysanias, possibly the son of the first Lysanias, and Luke got it right. But we only found it out many, many years later by this inscription. It wasn't even something that you could have gotten from a book at the time. So that's really cool, because it turned it right around from looking like an error to being a confirmation.
Cambridge New Testament scholar Peter J. Williams, author of Can We Trust the Gospels, has also done much work examining the historical clues to the authenticity of the Gospels, pointing out that, by comparison, later so-called apocryphal and Gnostic Gospels contain almost zero local knowledge of names, geography, and places, whereas The four Gospels in our Bible are brimming with such details, including knowledge of local customs and traditions.
You get some of the interesting things where Jesus will be telling the parable of the wise and foolish virgins who are waiting for a bridegroom to arrive. And the bizarre thing is that he arrives and a cry goes up at midnight in Jesus' parable. And according to Matthew, he's telling this parable exactly at Passover time. And we know independently that at Passover time, they happen to read the Passover narrative where you have that very particular phrase where a cry goes up in the middle of the night in Egypt. And there's a division between those who are saved and those who are not. And so it really makes sense if not only Jesus tells this parable, but he tells it at that very time. So, but no attention is drawn to that within the narrative. So that sort of thing, you get repeatedly in the Gospels that when it says something happens at a particular time, it makes most sense if it really was told at that time.
What about specific history, I guess, that the, you know, obviously the Gospel writers mention specific people, historical events, and so on. What sort of things do you find, again, give the ring of truth to these accounts there?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, if Jesus's main teaching is around the Sea of Galilee, well, basically, we have almost no other reports from anything around the Sea of Galilee at the time. So you are left with these reports on their own. Now, that isn't a reason for skepticism, because a lot of the time when, let's say, you have a Holocaust survivors report, there's no other report alongside it from the same place telling you exactly the same thing. But you can look for rings of truth. You can say, where does that intersect with other things that we know? And it all stacks up. So what I'd say is the way that the Gospels together dovetail is significant, but you do get interaction with external history. So John the Baptist is not just mentioned in the Gospels. He's also mentioned outside in Josephus. You get political figures who are mentioned and some of the characteristics of them, whether it's of Herod or Pontius Pilate, really stack up. So those are things you could look at too.
Lydia McGrew told me how even throwaway references to local prejudices about where you came from give further clues to the natural historicity of these accounts.
Someone goes and tells Nathaniel, hey, we've found the Messiah. It's Jesus of Nazareth. And, you know, he says, Nathaniel says, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And it's just this reflexive, you know, anti-Galilean bias. Or in the early chapters of Acts, when Peter and John are brought before the high priest, so they would consider themselves, you know, the elite, and they can tell by their accent that they're Galileans. And so they're very surprised that they have so much self-confidence in theological matters and that they're speaking up and they're leading this new religious movement. So in these indirect ways in the Gospels and Acts, we find indications of this prejudice against the Galileans, which we also can then confirm from external sources.
In a sense, the fact that that exists in the Gospels, you can see that the writers are acknowledging these local things, these traditions, these customs and so on, gives us confidence again that they knew what they were talking about, that someone who was writing at a later time and date wouldn't have realized that this was the way Galileans were sort of seen locally and so on.
Yes, absolutely. And it's also in there so naturally. This is something we really need to pick up on. This was not a time of hyper realistic fiction. They had fiction, but it tended to be what we might call purple, very over the top. But these things, these customs, they come up in a natural way, woven into the story. There's no sense of the author sort of going and trying in a labored fashion to bring it in. Rather, as in that case of Nathaniel, okay, it's just, that's what this guy said when somebody told him that they had found the Messiah and he was from Nazareth. Totally believable, totally realistic, but arises naturally from the story. So the authors are not being self-conscious about it. They probably it probably never in a million years occurred to them, hey, I gotta go find some customs and stick them in my story to make them look historical. Rather, they just do look historical because they arise in such an organic way within the story.
When it comes to whether the Gospels contain eyewitness testimony, New Testament historian Richard Borkum's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, published in 2006, is generally regarded as a groundbreaking piece of scholarship. His research communicates how the Gospels are filled with evidence that the authors were reporting eyewitness accounts of the very first followers of Christ. For instance, a strong case can be made that the Gospel of Mark is based on the first-hand accounts of the Apostle Peter. Even the Gospel of John, often assumed to be a later, more theological account of Jesus' life, contains multiple clues to being the work of a direct disciple of Jesus. Borkum also examines the way names appear in the Gospel, as he explained in this conversation with Sean McDowell.
Well, the interesting thing is, and this is something I don't think anyone had previously explained, there was some names like Pilate and Herod. I mean, these are famous public figures. I mean, it's not surprising that their names appear in the Gospels. And then there are major characters like the disciples of Jesus, Peter, Mary Magdalene. You would expect those people to be named quite often. But if you look at the minor characters, and there are a great many minor characters in the Gospels, people who meet Jesus just once and they're healed, or Jesus says something to them. Those characters are usually anonymous in the Gospels. And that's not really surprising. You know, Jesus healed a paralytic man. People may not even have remembered his name. It wasn't important. He was only a minor character. So why is it that sometimes these minor characters do have names, or their relatives have names? I'm thinking of Jairus' daughter, or Zacchaeus the tax collector, Bartimaeus the blind beggar. Why do these people have names? And the answer that I think is fairly convincing is that these stories were originally told by that named person. So that the name of the person who was healed or met Jesus, as it were, came with the story. And when Mark, for example, wrote the story of Bartimaeus the blind beggar, he may have heard it himself from Bartimaeus. I mean, you can imagine, Bartimaeus, we do know this, became a member of the earliest Christian community in Jerusalem. And you can imagine, he just went around telling everybody his story. It's the most exciting thing that ever happened to him, transformed his life. Mm. So everybody would have heard Bartimaeus telling his story, and they could have included Mark, or maybe Peter heard it and Mark heard it from Peter. But in any case, they knew it as Bartimaeus' story, and they kept his name there because he was the one who originally told it.
Perhaps most fascinating is Borkum's research on how the names used in the New Testament are perfectly synchronized with the time and place of Jesus. You see, the frequency of names in the Gospels was cross-checked with Israeli scholar Tali Lan's research from burial sites into the names being used during the time. Here's Amy Orr Ewing again, speaking on what names turned out to be the most popular at the time of Jesus in Judea.
Number one, Simon. Number two, Joseph. Number three, Lazarus. Number four, Judas. Number five, John. Six, Jesus. Seven, Ananias. Okay, and so it goes on. If you take the top nine most popular Jewish male names in Judea, Palestine in the first century together outside of the New Testament, they are 41% of names used. If you take them inside the New Testament, they are 40% of names used. And that's a pattern showing up over four writers writing five books. And remember, so because we include Acts, so the four Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, and remember, written far, far, far away, some of them. This pattern, this statistically testable pattern, shows up. It's absolutely amazing. Now, in case you're not incredibly wowed by this, which I hope you are, if you rank the names that people were called in Jewish communities in first century Judea, Palestine, and compare it with another country not very far away where there is a large Jewish community, Greco-Roman Egypt, first century. Just a few miles away, and you look at the names of what people were called then, you see a different pattern. The most common names in Jewish inscriptions of men in Greco-Roman Egypt in the first century are, number one, Eleazar, Lazarus. Two, Sabbateus. Three, Joseph. Four, Dosithius. Five, Pappus. Six, Ptolemaeus. Seven, Samuel. And so it goes on. Names like Sabbateus, Dosithius, and Pappus are in the top 10 in Egypt, but they're not in the Gospels at all. Why not? Because the Gospels are not written about Jewish people living in first century Greco-Roman Egypt. They're written about Jewish people living in first century Judea.
As Amy Orr-Ewing, drawing on Borkum's research, shows, the Gospels are full of the same names that were common in the time and place where Jesus lived. Any prospective parent who's looked up the most popular baby names that are published each year will know that the most common names change frequently. But the Gospel writers got it right for their time and place. It's a strong confirmation that these accounts were not made up in some other location at a later time. You can only get that sort of detail right if these accounts originate from people who were there and knew the people they were talking about. So, having looked at the growing body of research into archaeology, places, customs, and names, here's one more fascinating piece of recent evidence corroborating the authenticity of the Gospels. Undesigned coincidences between the Gospel accounts. Lydia McGrew.
I like to tell what an undesigned coincidence is sometimes by giving a hypothetical example, a modern example. So suppose that you have two people who both claim to have witnessed a robbery, and they're being interviewed by the police, and one of them says he tripped when he was running away. And the other person's being interviewed and describes the robber's clothing and says, one of his shoes was untied. The person who mentions that the shoe was untied doesn't mention that he tripped, and the person who mentioned that he tripped doesn't mention that his shoe was untied. That's an undesigned coincidence. They fit together in this case, so what I call a classic undesigned coincidence. They fit together explanatorily. One bit of information explains the other or answers a question like, why did he trip? But they don't appear to be trying to refer to what each other said, because they don't mention what each other said. They just give their side of the story, their view, what it looks like from their side.
And your argument is, of course, that there are such undesigned coincidences between different Gospels specifically. And again, this would have been nigh on impossible for someone to kind of manufacture after the fact. And so we have to accept that if these undesigned coincidences do exist, there's a common historical narrative that binds all of these accounts of Jesus' life together. It's not woven from whole cloth and so on. So give us an example of one or two undesigned coincidences.
Sure. One of my favorite ones surrounds the feeding of the 5,000, which is, of course, a miracle. But this part of it isn't directly about the miracle. But hey, you know, it does raise the probability that this incident happened. You find there's this big crowd. And in the Gospel of John, Jesus looks at the crowd and then you could sort of picture a little twinkle in his eye. He turns to Philip and he says, where shall we buy food that these may eat? And it even says, you know, he knew what he was going to do. So in other words, he's sort of teasing Philip in a way. You know, he's not really proposing that they find food. And Philip says, you know, that we could never buy enough food for all these people to eat, you know. And so a question that you can ask is, why does he ask Philip? Now, if it's invented, if the whole story is invented, you know, you're going to maybe have a 1 out of 12 probability if John just, you know, picked a disciple at random, right? But maybe even less than that, because we can think of disciples that would be more likely to be mentioned. You know, you find in the apocryphal gospels, it's only the most prominent people usually who get mentioned. Like they'll pick, you know, a few. Mary Magdalene, they might decide to emphasize Thomas or something, but it's not Peter, you know, it's not Judas who had the money or anything like that. So why Philip? Well, okay, could have just been Jesus was speaking to the person standing nearest to him. But there's actually a better explanation of that. But you have to put together another passage, totally different location in John, and then another passage from Luke. So when you go to a different location in John, it mentions that Philip was from the town of Bethsaida. Doesn't say this apropos of the feeding of the 5,000, and John doesn't mention anything about where the feeding of the 5,000 occurred as far as, you know, the specific town that they were nearest to. So what? Well, then you go over to Luke 9, and it mentions that they were in a deserted area and it was near the town of Bethsaida. So now it kind of makes sense that if Jesus is gonna, you know, push somebody a little bit, it might be someone local. Philip, where can we buy food that these people may eat? So then that explains why he asked Philip, but you have to put these three different passages together, and there's no self-consciousness again in the author. If you're gonna imagine that John invented that and put it together, he was being so subtle that it could easily be overlooked. That's a very important point, because to make stuff up fictionally and be that subtle about it, you're kind of ruining your own point. If you're so subtle that nobody notices it, what good have you done to yourself as far as getting people to believe your fictional story?
By itself, this single example is unlikely to convince a skeptic of the general trustworthiness of the Gospels. But I think the cumulative weight of the many additional examples that could be given should give a skeptic pause for thought. Like the pieces of a puzzle falling into place, the interlocking connections between multiple details in the Gospels can't be explained away by scribal ingenuity or later invention. As McGrew has said, all these undesigned coincidences are marks of the truth of the Gospels hidden in plain view. Alongside these undesigned coincidences, Lydia McGrew details many more lines of evidence in her book, Testimonies to the Truth, beginning with un, including unexpected harmonies, unnecessary details, unexplained allusions, unified personalities, and perhaps most importantly of all, the unmistakable character of Jesus that comes out in all four Gospels.
A lot of times you will hear scholars refer to the Jesus of fill in the blank, the Jesus of John, the Jesus of Luke, etc. And this can even, you know, this could be harmless, but it could even be taken to the point of saying it's a different Jesus. Bart Ehrman, whom you were mentioning, does that constantly. He'll say the Jesus of John is very different from the Jesus of the synoptics. But that's not true. And this is something I argued in my book, The Eye of the Beholder, and then something I argue here in Testimonies to the Truth. It's one of those great things that has both devotional and evidential importance. So, for example, one of the characteristics of Jesus that is so constant, we find it again and again over different stories, different gospels, is his need for his friends. He doesn't want them to leave him alone. He anticipates that they will, but he brings it up. So, for example, in the Garden of Gethsemane, in the Synoptic Gospels, he says, "Watch with me. Come and stay awake." And then he comes and he finds them sleeping and he says, "Could you not watch with me for 1 hour?" Very, very heartbreaking. But then you think of the Gospel of John, totally different story. After he's given the bread of life discourse and he's offended people by saying, "Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you cannot have eternal life." A lot of people quit. They're like, "I don't want anything to do with this guy anymore. He's weird." He turns to his disciples and he says, "Will you also go away?" It's the same person. You know, he predicts that they will leave him. He says, "You'll all be scattered this night." It bothers him. It hurts him that specific vulnerability and loneliness is characteristic of Jesus all across the Gospels, even in the Gospel of John, which the critics like to say Jesus is very exalted. It's almost like, and they're wrong. I mean, Jesus cries out, "I'm thirsty," in the Gospel of John. So he's got that feeling of vulnerability and loneliness and many other characteristics that I talk about in that chapter, which allows us to know that when we, for Christians, when we pray, when we speak to him, we're speaking to a real person, not to some sort of fictional or partially fictional or legendary person. There's no gap between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. There's only one Jesus.
Of course, becoming convinced that a real-life Jesus whose sayings and actions are faithfully recorded in ancient documents with a good historical pedigree isn't the same thing as saying he's the Son of God who performed miracles. In our next episode, we'll address whether some of the well-known secular thinkers who are taking the Bible seriously again as a work of great psychological and historical importance can also take seriously the central claim of the New Testament that Jesus rose again. But believe it or not, there are intelligent, modern-day, 21st century people moving from agnosticism and atheism to believing that Jesus really is the Son of God who rose again, precisely because of the historical evidence they've encountered for the truth of the Bible. I met one such person recently. Molly Worthen is a journalist and associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. For over a decade, she has pursued a career researching the religious and intellectual history of North America. As well as authoring books, she's been a regular contributor to publications such as the New York Times, The Atlantic, and The New Yorker. But Molly's story took an interesting turn only recently. Having grown up in a non-religious household, Molly had been an agnostic for most of her life, until in 2022, she was baptized. Having researched the good, the bad, and the ugly of Christian history, Molly isn't the first person you might expect to embrace faith. So what happened? When I sat down with her alongside Belle Tyndall for an edition of the Reenchanting podcast, Molly explained that she'd always felt a certain attraction towards aspects of Christianity, especially some Orthodox and high church traditions, but she'd never managed to get much beyond a "wouldn't it be nice if it were true" way of looking at it. Things changed, however, when she was sent on assignment to interview J.D. Greer, pastor of The Summit, one of America's largest churches.
I finally got to interview him in March of last year, and it was a really interesting conversation. The follow-up, he emailed me afterward, and we had a kind of nice follow-up correspondence that turned into an email conversation about Jesus and the historical evidence for the gospel narratives. And I realized as these emails were going back and forth that I was being evangelized.
He's very good at his job.
And but it's odd to say. I mean, I'd spent by this point, 15 plus years talking and spending a lot of time with evangelistically minded Christians. Mm-hmm. And occasionally at the end of an interview or something, they might ask me what my own views were. And I would always be honest and say, I guess I'm a seeker, although I hate that word. I'm an agnostic. And the most they might say would be, well, I'll pray for you. But I think there is a real stigma attached to evangelism. And I understand it. I mean, in our pluralistic society, evangelism is outrageous.
Yeah.
Right? Like what the premise of it, we all, our modern pluralistic democracy depends on all of us kind of holding our, if we have an exclusive truth claim, we have to sort of hold it very close to our chest and live in this cognitive dissonance where we don't, we don't constantly confront our neighbors with it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you really believe this stuff, I've always had a lot of respect for missionaries, people who do, share whatever their gospel is. And that was the case here. And as it unfolded, I realized that I had, I guess, a lot of questions bottled up that I hadn't even risen to the surface. And I think I was at a place where I was no longer satisfied with the worldview that I thought was my own. And I was beginning to, I was more open, I think, to the Christian line of critique that says secular liberals borrow a lot of their presuppositions, you know, by which they get to moral universals and the golden rule and all these things. They borrow those from the Judeo-Christian legacy. I was more open to that line of thinking.
Yeah. So it sounds like there were a few different sort of intellectual issues going on there. You were asking about sort of the nature of morality and the kind of evil that seems to be so prevalent under the surface in our culture. And then you're having this kind of question, sort of conversation with JD about the biblical reliability and that kind of thing. I mean, I'm guessing a lot of these weren't exactly completely new to you, some of these conversations, but did your thinking start to change as you were having those conversations?
Here was the big intervention that I only see in retrospect. Mm. I wasn't seeking out. If you're sincerely looking at converting, I think, to any of the world religions, but certainly Christianity, and as a fully formed, you know, thinking person, it's a lot of crazy stuff to take on at once.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the Jesus stuff. It's pretty nuts. There's a lot, you know, the whole Bible is full of the things that are very hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
You know, there's heaven and hell, the end times. You know, there's the sexual ethic that is totally at odds with modern secular liberal culture. It's an awful lot. And I think I was paralyzed. I didn't know, how do I get in, right? I mean, if I would maybe begin to investigate one piece of it, and then I would start to remember, wait, but there's all the other bananas stuff. How can I even be taking this seriously? I can't go any further. And what JD helped me see was that Christianity is a bit unique, and really it stands or falls on this single claim about this thing that Christians say happened in history. Mm-hmm. And that is that the tomb was empty.
Yeah.
And that Jesus rose from the dead. And on top of that, it turns out that there is a lot more quite interesting, provocative, and compelling historical evidence around, you know, that set of events than I had realized, really to my embarrassment. I mean, I'm a historian of Christianity, not of the first century period, but I'm a historian of Christianity. And I think I had somehow just absorbed from the ether sort of mid-20th century Jesus seminar sort of New Testament criticism view that, well, it's sort of all...
It's all a bit fuzzy.
Mythologizer, yeah. Fuzzy. It's kind of like a game of telephone. Who knows what happened? You know, there's this thing, like core Jesus we can't access, and then the accretions of all the supernatural stuff. But I'd never really done my homework. So I said to JD, because he would come back, I would throw these questions at him, which I'm sure he'd heard a million times, but he took them all incredibly seriously. And he said to me at one point, Molly, God will not honor any conversion unless you are totally investigating this intellectually. Like, you cannot turn your brain off. Mm. And I thought, wow, that, yeah. I really needed to hear that. Mm. And I said, well, I like to read stuff. I like homework. Just give me homework. And so he reconnoitered with some other theologian colleagues. He told me that he asked Tim Keller, the pastor who died recently in New York, about sort of my case, which this was very sort of strategic.
He took it straight to the top, basically. I mean, it sounds like you were being treated as a very special case.
Well, and so this was very clever, right? Because it's very flattering. So I was like, oh, these fancy pastors are interested in my case. I guess I need to sort of let this play out. And I began to get kind of excited because I'd always wanted to be a Christian. I just didn't think it was... I always thought, wouldn't it be great if it's true? Too bad it's probably not true. Mm. But I had not actually looked at the evidence. So he came back with a reading list for me. Prominent on this reading list was N.T. Wright's giant book on the resurrection and the Son of God.
Yeah.
Richard Bauckham's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. So a number of very smart Anglicans. Mm. Again, he knew, he sensed correctly... Like, even though I'm a scholar of American evangelicalism, I think I write pretty sympathetically about American evangelicals. he sensed the sort of intellectual snobbery. Like the way to win this gal over is not by recommending like a bunch of Southern Baptists. I need to go to the British Anglicans because she's clearly Anglophilic. There's like this Anglo-Catholic thing happening in her history. It's very smart. And I began reading these books alongside more popular apologetics. I read a lot of Tim Keller. And often I would get kind of lost in the weeds of Tom Wright's book, which I love. It was the crucial intervention for me, but it is an intense 800-page. I wouldn't call it a romp, right? Like, it's like so there would be moments where I would say, well, wait, why am I sort of so far in the weeds on first century Jewish attitudes toward this or that piece of the afterlife? And I would go back and read Tim Keller's chapter in his book, The Reason for God, his chapter on the resurrection, to sort of regain my perspective. This whole time, I was having to take pretty intense notes and found myself keeping a journal, which I'm not inclined to do ordinarily, but I had to keep recording my reactions to what I was reading. You know, N.T. Wright walks you through, you know, first century Greek and Roman and Jewish views of the afterlife and resurrection, and builds the case that what the first Christians said happened to Jesus is not at all something that they had pre-existing historical or cultural categories for. Rising from the dead and appearing to disciples was not something that first century self-proclaimed messiahs were in the habit of doing. And while in isolation, either the empty tomb or the reports of his appearances would not be by themselves a persuasive case for the resurrection of Jesus, that in combination and in that very particular, finely grained cultural context, there is a compelling case to take it seriously.
Because in a sense, you're being drawn towards something which is probably the last thing you probably expected to be the thing that might do it for you. And yet there you are. Is it possible, and maybe you're just not the kind of person, as you say, who's going to have that typical born again experience, but was there a point at which some line got crossed where you said, no, I think I do have to surrender to this, even if I don't feel like I've got God on speed dial or anything like that? What was that sort of process?
I was, over the course of last summer, continually praying, you know, God, just show yourself to me. Like, I just need it doesn't have to be something dramatic. I just need a nudge. And I would take these concerns to JD, and he said, you know, you have to just accept God makes people with different temperaments. And he explained to me that here he is a pastor and he doesn't have a rich history of, you know, thunderous experiences with the Holy Spirit. And you just have to take what God gives you, essentially. I found that very frustrating. I would sort of listen to it and go away. And I was continuing to do both the reading on the resurrection and also reading on cosmology and the Big Bang. Francis Collins' book, The Language of God, was really significant for me. Francis Collins, too, as I learned about his autobiography, was one of the few models I had encountered of someone who converted as an adult. You know, he became head of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health in the United States, and a very fancy genetic scientist. But he grew up in a secular family, converted in med school. And so there was a model or two like that. Although still, as I learned about those autobiographies, they seemed to have more of a robust emotional component than I had. But I just kept rereading my notes and thinking, well, I'm not 99.5% persuaded that the resurrection is the best explanation for the evidence we have. But I know I am well north of 51%. This is a late summer.
It's a very historic and historical scientific way of kind of assessing the probabilities there.
Well, here's the other thing. I didn't want to convert out of cowardice.
Sure.
I was really... So the sermons that would make me the maddest would be the ones full of comfort.
Right.
Like, you know, I remember JD lost his mother shortly before Easter 2022, and his Easter sermon was all about the comfort that Christianity offers you in the face of death, and, you know, how he'll see his mother again, and, you know, she's with Jesus and all of this. And I just made my skin crawl.
Wow.
I didn't want to convert for a bribe. I'm only interested in the bribe if it's attached to something true. So I needed the whole process to feel rigorous. And I do think that that God made this path for me that is very idiosyncratic, but was exactly what I needed. And so by the end of last summer, I got to the point where I thought, if I want the emotional side of it, and as I was talking about this with Christian friends, they would say, well, you seem to be describing the experience of faith, and faith is a relationship with God. Mm. And you can't, it's sort of like becoming friends with somebody. You know, there's a certain amount of investigation and intelligence you can gather about a person before you really know them. Mm-hmm. You can Google them and have a first chat or whatever. But at a certain point, you can't know what they're like as a friend until you make yourself vulnerable and you trust them and you actually take the step of entering into that relationship. And so maybe to get the sort of the feeling part that I was so hungry for, this relationship with Jesus that evangelicals talk about, I had to actually take that step. And so, you know, I took a lot of comfort in, you know, what Paul says, you know, if you believe with your heart that Jesus died for our sins and confess with your mouth that he rose, that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That's like the core. And that I could agree to sort of struggle with all the other pieces and all the other doubts that are absolutely still persistent, and that is the core. And so I found myself confessing that.
Molly Worthen was surprised, not only to discover that there was a historically credible basis to the story of Jesus in the Bible, but also to find that despite her Anglo-Catholic leanings and suspicions of US evangelicalism, she found her spiritual home in a North Carolina megachurch where, in August 2022, she was baptized by J.D. Greer. You can hear her full story on the Reenchanting podcast. I believe we are seeing a generation beginning to ask the same kinds of questions that had troubled Molly. Can secular culture deliver on its promises? Those myths about God and Jesus that seem to have shaped us so much, wouldn't it be nice if they were really true? To her own amazement, Molly found it was true, as her questions and longings were met by a real-life person from history who stepped out of the pages of Scripture and into her world. And I'm led to think, if it can happen to Molly Worthen, maybe it can happen to anyone. You've been listening to The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, telling the story of how new atheism grew old and secular thinkers are considering Christianity again. Material from The Unbelievable Show was used by permission of Premier. Visit premierunbelievable.com for full shows or today's show notes for links to all archive materials used in this episode. And just to remind you, this podcast series is also a book. You can read the first chapter for free when you join my newsletter at justinbrierley.com, where you can also order the book or get a signed copy. Supporting via Patreon or tax-deductible giving from the USA will give you early access to new episodes of the podcast and access to bonus content. Find out more and how to support my efforts to bring thinking faith to the secular and Christian world at justinbrierley.com. The links are with today's show. Coming up next time.
Well, it's quite odd, really. I just got obsessed with the New Testament and particularly quest for the historical Jesus, historicity. I mean, all the classical stuff I'd done suddenly turned to this question of historicity and apologetics, sort of New Testament apologetics, I suppose.
A classicist meets Jesus as we explore the surprising rebirth of belief in the resurrection. Today's episode was a production of Think Faith in partnership with Genexis and with support from the Jerusalem Trust. Editing assistance by Isaac Simmons. You can find links to the book and all our featured guests with the show notes. As ever, please do subscribe to this podcast, do rate and review us, and tell others too. Share it on your social media. It really helps others to discover us. Plus, you can get the next episode that you just heard a clip from 2 weeks early when you support now at justinbrierley.com. Again, the link is with today's show. See you next time. Hi there, it's Justin again. Thanks for listening. Just a reminder, If you want more Thinking Faith, then do get our newsletter at the link with today's episode. I'll even send you the first chapter of the Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God book when you do so. If you can support this show, you'll get access to new episodes 2 weeks early and bonus content, such as the video of our Tom Holland conversation event in London. Gold level supporters will also receive a signed copy of my book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. Just click the link with today's show.